May all be happy as we go through the basket of fun tonight. Okay, so, yeah, this is just a sort of tradition we have on these retreats to have a box of questions, and you get all sorts, and I'll try to answer them one by one, and I'll try to get through them all. It's 8:05 now, so let's see how we do. Ah, okay, good. Is walking meditation just as effective as sitting meditation? And what about closing your eyes? Definitely keep your eyes open, because otherwise you'll walk into things and hurt yourself. unless you have really good psychic powers, then you can do it. Is it as effective as sitting meditation? Simply, no. You're not going to get as deep in meditation, doing walking meditation, but the combination of walking and sitting means that you can practice for much, much longer during the day, because when you're walking, you stand up, you stretch the muscles in your legs, and you have that sense of physical comfort that you would not have if you tried to just sit for 10 hours a day. Yeah, but it can be enjoyable. I mean, the nice thing about walking meditation, and Ajahn Brahm said this, is you don't get anywhere. I mean, apart from the fact that you're going back and forwards on a path, you also there's no real deep attainments to strive for and worry about. So, yeah, so that's question one. Question two. Namaste. Namaste. Would you recommend any particular practice to overcome a judgmental mind, i.e. the habit of judging people and experiences, etc.? I'd say contentment. Contentment is really just such a nice feeling to have. If you value your contentment, you will not judge. And what are you judging, really? I mean, unless you know the whole history of this person that you're judging, or everything about the situation, who are you to judge? Maybe we see things in all sorts of wrong ways. So always give people the benefit of the doubt. Best way to say it. Okay. Venerable JR, that's me. What book or guided meditation would you recommend for a new meditator or someone trying to establish a more regular or routine practice? Thank you. Well, I mean, Ajahn Brahm's book, The Basic Method of Meditation, The Basic Method of Meditation is a good place to start. It's free and it's also available on the web. He's written another book called Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond. I think that's the title. The title in other countries might be Happiness Through Meditation or something, due to publishers doing what publishers do. But if you can find that, and I'm sure it's in the Dhammaloka bookstore. That's another good thing. If you can get up to Nolamara, they have a wonderful library. They have a huge, huge library of just books and books and books. And a lot of stuff that is quite good for new meditators. You even drop in and say hello to the librarian and they might have some suggestions. So, I'm going to be talking about metta meditation tomorrow morning. There's another good book called Loving Kindness by Sharon Salzberg, and it's one of the few books written on the subject. I mean, she's not a monk or a nun, but if you're interested in learning formal metta meditation, that's a good thing to have a look at. Dear Venerable JR, ooh, okay. I experienced a ball of intense light this morning. Awesome. Then I heard myself say, wow, that was intense. Awesome. Then the light dulled and went away. Oh, was this an imitator? Was this an imitator? What do I do to keep it? It almost felt too intense, like my mind was electric. Well, I'm not one to judge your own mind, but it sounds like it was a really interesting experience. And that's the sort of thing that can actually happen on retreats. Someone who's a very novice meditator might actually just spontaneously have a nice deep meditation. I can't say for sure whether that was a true nimitta or not, but it certainly sounds like it was accompanied by a lot of joy and happiness, and that's always a sign that you're going in the right direction. And also, what does it say? What do I do to keep it? Well, I know. I mean, I'm no expert on this sort of thing, but I know what Ajahn Brahm would say. He'd say, "You don't do anything. If you do anything at this stage of the meditation, you'll go back to square one." But that's okay. It's nice to fluke these things and gives us a bit of encouragement. And it's always interesting. I spoke to a few people this afternoon who had. Some very strange and interesting experiences, like tingling sensations, they're all recognizable as stages of meditation. So I love those experiences. I'd like to hear more about. I'd like to hear about more of them. Dear friend or JR, sometimes when I meditate, my nasal passages get very sensitive, and I smell a strange smell. Is this normal? I think the lunch smelled right today, so it couldn't have been that. I don't think the Bimax is backed up yet, so it's not that. I guess it's possible you could have an olfactory hallucination. I suppose that's possible. I've never heard of it happening to meditators before, but strange things can happen. Okay. Plowing through them, but they're still. How deep does this go? Are these all note? No, they're blank pieces of paper, so I don't have to rush too fast. We're doing quite well. Good question. What is the story behind the teddy bears in the hall? They are our equipment for the meta meditation that we're going to be doing. Okay, so these bears, they look innocuous, but they can inspire great amounts of meta if used properly. And I'll mention that. I'll talk more on that tomorrow. You laugh, but it's true. You'll be full of meta. Thank you, JR. Thank you. What do you do when fear and strong emotions arise in our practice? Do we kindly as possible welcome them with mindful awareness? Yes. Yes, you do. Fear and strong emotions. Yeah, it's interesting. I was reading a sutta today, or maybe yesterday. It was called Fear and Dread. It's from the Majjhima Nikaya. And it talks about what happens when monks go out and live in the middle of the forest in really deep jungle. Not like this, not like a hall out in the forest, which is quite comfortable. But perhaps compared to home, it's a little bit more foresty. But and he said that for meditators without a strong foundation will come across these things when they start to do. Perhaps you could relate to the more intense meditation that you've been doing over the last couple of days. So, I know a lot of you really you've come here with just a practice of a few minutes a day, that sort of thing. So, it's not uncommon when you start to. Come along to I wouldn't call this intensive, but relatively intensive meditation retreat. Things can arise in the mind. I don't know exactly what sort of fear you have, whether it's sense of strong emotions. Yeah, these things can come up. They can be unexpected. And I suppose, yeah, the main thing is to just not to worry too much, to be kind to yourself. Yeah, go and stand up and go outside and just enjoy a bit of sunlight for a while, just have a glass of water or a cup of tea, that sort of thing. So, yeah, we don't have to sort of force our way through it. Okay. Hope that helps. What was that, man? Okay, I'll try and... Okay. What do you do when your mind does everything to obscure the present moment by taking bits of the past and mixing up with bits of imaginary futures that make no sense at all? That's true, actually. And right, so this whole process of thinking and past and future, what will often happen is something that happened in the past will come to mind, and we'll take it up and decide that it's something that we have to deal with in the future. And it often goes this way. It sort of the mind runs in this direction from past to future. So it's not always just thinking about a certain memory or thinking about a certain thing that could happen. It's this process of the mind just agitating itself over back and forth across the past and the future. So what to do? What to do? Well, you let it be. You let these things be. They come, they go. We talked about this morning about the two big bags of luggage, the past and the future. And the really important thing is not so much concentrating on the difficulties, but actually perceiving that there is actually another way. There's another way for the mind to be. It doesn't have to be caught up with the past. It doesn't have to be caught up with the future. And as we practice, we'll have more and more of these moments where we're not thinking about the past and future, and we recognise the happiness there, and it grows. That's pretty much it. Yeah. Okay. Dear Venerable JR, thank you for your teachings. No worries. Could you please share some advice about dealing with self-critical thoughts about one's practice? I am a really lousy practitioner. I should be able to let go. More on this, etc., etc. Now, yeah, that would be a hindrance. Which hindrance is it? Ill will, and is it external or internal? Internal. So, there we go. It all fits into our nice tenfold category. Excuse me, I'll just stretch for a moment. Yeah, and the way to practice with ill will, whether it's internal or external, is to develop metta. Yeah, it's about as simple as that. That was the sutta I was reading today, that you let go of the critical thoughts, especially about yourself in this particular case. You just let it go by cultivating its opposite, just having kindness to yourself and say, well, you know, meditation isn't easy. I don't know if I mentioned this at the beginning of the retreat, but it needs to be, you need to remind people that it's a gradual training, and it can take a while to get to the end of the path, so be kind. Okay. Often after exercise, I feel calm, happy, and contented. Similar to the benefits of meditation, why does the Buddha not encourage exercise? That's an interesting question. I don't think the... I think the Buddha said that being healthy is good. It's a good good way to be. My guess is that exercise alone, physical exercise, while not a bad thing, will not take you all the way to the end of suffering, basically, which is... which is the end point of the Buddha's practice. We're talking about, letting go. I mean, I'm not much of a gym junkie or anything like that, but I have to say I do enjoy the feeling once I've just done a good stretch. I usually do about half an hour of stretching each day. That can be quite pleasant as well, which is not a problem, and it also means that the body is limber, and you don't feel it so much when you're meditating, so you can meditate for longer periods. So I think they're both very much complementary, good physical health. But we also have to give ourselves a break when the body isn't healthy and it aches and you've got all sorts of worries about your body, that's the time just to let it be, because it's not always under control. Okay. And I don't have too many to go. I think I've done pretty well. Maybe I've been going through too fast, but anyway, we can all go to bed early tonight or get an extra half hour of meditation in this evening. This is a good question. How can children start learning about meditation and the Dharma? How to teach them? Well, we had this book turn up in the library at the monastery. It was a picture book from Wisdom Publications about the monkey that was not mindful and the panda who was very, very mindful. And as Venerable Bardo said, what a load of sanctimonious... I won't say that word. I think my point is that you can really turn kids off by making them learn about religion, I think. Anything that you have a vested interest in them learning, if you push them too far, they might actually turn the other way. I don't know. I haven't got any kids. My sister's got a kid, but she doesn't speak yet, so we haven't actually had this conversation. So she would be a little bit too old because she doesn't have the ability to understand English. I think Ajahn Brahm's a good case. He started getting into meditation, I think, when he was about 16 or something. So once he's matured and had the chance to look at it with a sort of sceptical teenage eye, he found something that he liked that resonated with him. At the same time, I mean, I've had to get my... I just went in on Wednesday, put in my working with children check so I can get my little card so I can legally teach children to meditate or whatever, but you do get children coming to the Armidale meditation group. Those tend to be in their mid-teens, I think. That was at a rough guess just by sight. So, yeah, but you can always say, well, I'm interested in this. Your mum, your dad's interested in this. It might interest you too, and that's fine. I think but when it comes to religion especially, I think it's easy to have the opposite effect of what you intend. But yeah, I'd say 15, 16 is a good time to start meditating when the exams get all too tough and you really need that help. Although you have this idea of they bring up with kids of quiet time, and I think even just having some time without tablets and TVs and stuff is good for them. Ah, okay. Okay. Is it possible to explain what deep meditation feels like? Right. Okay. So, how do I answer this question? Someone was asking me today in the interviews, what uttari manusa dharma have you attained, Janarato? And I had the wonderful out of saying, I'm not allowed to tell you. But Ajahn Brahm's a good person to talk to. And he says that he started out by saying this is a bliss better than sex. So we're talking about here we're talking about like the jhanas, talking about the really deep states of meditation. I think they get happier and happier as you go inward. So you can start it with the happiness just of being in the present moment. That's a reasonable amount of happiness. It's a good amount of happiness if you can keep it up for a long periods of time. And then as you go into the silent mind, that's more happy again, more blissful again. The breath, as it gets more refined and subtle and turns into the delightful breath, you're heading in that direction. The other anecdote was Ajahn Brahm. Someone turned up at the monastery and they were an ex-heroin addict. So they had that experienced the I guess as high as pharmaceuticals can get you in terms of happiness. And when he got a very deep meditation, he said, "Wow, that's just so much better than better than the most powerful drugs." And then I think the good quality that comes along with that sort of happiness is that. It stays with you for possibly for the rest of your life, in a way that a lot of sensory happiness, like going to a movie, you might see a good movie, but you see that movie a few times and it's not that interesting after a while, or you hear a cool song. I always found I'd hear a song, I'd not be interested in it, then I'd hear it a few times and I thought, oh wow, that's really cool, and then after a while I'd get sick of it. So that's the sort of sensory happiness. But with meditation, the deep meditation, the happiness is something that stays on and is profound. It's something you can reflect on. And in fact, that's exactly what you're supposed to do when you get deep meditations, is to reflect on that state. Cool. Well, we got 1, 2, well, I've got a few more to go. And it's 8:30, which is fine. So we'll get through these tonight, which is good. All right, okay. Okay. I don't know if I can answer this one. What is the latest research into the clinical benefits of meditation? Well, I could add it to my Google News feed and I'd probably know. I don't know. I haven't heard anything specific recently. There's been a bit of research into, you hear a lot about past life memories, that sort of stuff. That comes up quite often. Children who can track down the murderers of their previous existence, which is pretty cool. So there was definitely some, I don't know about clinical benefits, there's not really clinical benefits, but I know there was a study Ajahn Brahm was talking about where they sent some people off to a spa, it's a relaxation spa, and then they gave a couple other people told them to go off on a retreat, on a meditation retreat, and the result showed categorically that the people who went to the spa were much happier. So anyway, there's a bit more to it than that. I mean, you've noticed that throughout this retreat I've been talking very much about relaxing and letting go, and that's not always what's taught on retreats. If you try too hard, you can make yourself very unhappy. But if you relax and do it over a long period of time, not just a weekend, I'm not sure how many people would really like to be in a spa for, you know, weeks on end. It would get a bit boring after a while. So, yeah, clinical benefits. I don't know. If anyone has some ideas, let me know. Mm. Has anyone read anything recently? Meditation? You. Hello.
Hi. I've read a book called Mindfulness is Better Than Chocolate by David Michie.
Oh, Mindfulness is Better Than Chocolate. Oh, okay. Oh, cool, okay. Mindfulness is Better Than Chocolate. Okay, so you can all get onto Amazon. If you've got Kindle, you can find out tomorrow. Hello.
There was a DVD as well. It's called The Connection. So they like the meditation and the effects of it.
The Connection, you called it?
Yeah.
It's a movie, is it?
It's like a documentary.
Documentary, yeah. Oh, shrink the amygdala, yes, because the amygdala is the fight or flight part of the brain.
Yeah,
the
sure.
Yeah, cool. So, yeah, okay, that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah. And it's used in prisons as well. As that another DVD that came around was the Dharma Brothers, so... They were practicing, I think, Vipassana, sort of Goenka-style meditation in the prisons and how that all worked out for them. And yeah, so I think, yeah, it helps in a remarkable number of situations, not everywhere, but yeah. Okay, good. Okay, here we go. I see a bright green colour when I have a deep meditation. How do I interpret this? Okay. Well, you can interpret it as being really cool because we all like having nimittas and stuff. And yeah. Ajahn Brahm's... Yeah, if it's a real nimitta, and it could well be, Ajahn Brahm would probably say that the... Well, okay, so from the basic method of meditation... Which is where I draw a lot of my my information from. He'd say that it doesn't actually matter what it really is, whether it's a golden light, whether it's a sort of blue pearl or anything like that. That's not so much important. The important part is that it's very bright. It's accompanied by a lot of joy, a lot of bliss. And if it stays around for a long period of time, that bliss is only going to grow. The actual colour and that sort of thing, as far as I know, is not that important. The brightness and the stability of it as well, the stillness, are probably the most important factors. If they're very, very still, it's possible to go deeper. Right. How can I introduce more compassion for others, compassion for self, into my life and practice? Yeah, I mean, you're talking about changing your outlook on life, which is not always something we can do in... one easy step. Compassion for others, yeah. Yeah, just having that sense of forgiveness. Understanding that we're all sort of flawed in one way or another. We don't have to let people walk all over us, but at the same time, often it's just as easy to offer forgiveness when someone trespasses and makes us unhappy. I guess the other side of it too is if someone's deeply unhappy, we've got the opportunity to help them and... have compassion in that situation. I mean, it depends on the motivation you want. you have for wanting to develop compassion. We can forgive our enemies and that sort of thing, but also there's a lot of people who are just stuck in bad places. I mean, samsara is full of them. I think possibly just seeing the universality of suffering in the world. When you see that everyone suffers, we just say, oh, you know, so to them like myself. In practical terms, yeah, you can practice metta meditation. There's, well, I'll talk about that a bit more tomorrow, but it's interesting. I know some teachers tend to focus more on the loving kindness side of things in comparison to compassion. They're two slightly different things in the Buddha's teachings, the karuna and the metta. Sometimes the compassion can turn into a kind of pity, which might not be so helpful. It's usually a lot easier to just wish someone well, may they be happy, rather than say, well, may they be fixed. You know, they've got some sort of problem with them and you want that to go away. I think simply just to wish people well, because it's the right thing to do. It makes them happy and makes you happy. Yeah, okay. Okay, two more notes. Okay. Okay, so I am having difficulty forgiving someone who has let me down and I have lost trust in. I know it is good for me to forgive, but I can't seem to do it. Help! Right, yeah. Well, there's a bit of a theme here, I think. Sorry. We're talking about just having ill will to other people. In this case, specifically to other people. So that sort of external ill will. And, I mean, I've said over and over again, meta, but what else can you say in terms of letting go of ill will? I think you get a taste for forgiveness. Once you've done it a few times, you can. It becomes a bit of a habit, and when someone upsets you, you just almost instantly forgive them. That's pretty much my practice in living in a community, a small community. Well, you know, quite a large number of monks, but. A small place, and we're sort of in each other's hair a lot of the time, and there are arguments from time to time, and people say and do the wrong things and upset people, and it becomes easier every time. You just think, why would I waste time on these feelings of ill will when they're not of any benefit to me, they're not of any benefit to the other person, and instead you let it go. And what tends to happen is you get more harmony in the community, and harmony takes work. I think that's something that people might forget sometimes, is that we all want a harmonious world where everyone gets along, but yeah, it takes effort, and the effort is often just the effort to forgive. So it's not always easy, but if you make a habit of it, it becomes easier. So it's probably the best I can suggest for those sorts of problems. But of course, yeah, in the meditation as well, learning to let go of the past. Every moment's a new moment, and the future is made in the present moment. So, that practice, I often find I'm back in my hut or I'm just somewhere in the monastery, usually back in my hut, and I've got a sort of messy mind state. It might be anger, it might be whatever. and I always know that if I want to improve my mind state, I should meditate. So, yeah, regardless of what it is that you want to overcome and let go of, there's not much, there's no real substitute for sitting on the cushion, sitting on the chair, and just practicing letting go. Yeah. Okay. Oh, okay. That's a good one to finish on. Is there an ultimate goal or purpose of meditation? Aha, okay. So, yes, there is. Okay, so I'm a Theravadan Buddhist monk, so I have my own perspective on these things. But essentially, meditation is part of the Eightfold Path. We talk about, I haven't really mentioned that over all this time, but essentially it can be broken down into three parts, the one of which is meditation. But as a support for that is we and foundation for our meditation practice, there's the practice of virtue, which is that principle of non-harm, of acting kindly in body, speech, and mind, with the people we interact with the beings we interact with, from the bugs up to the kangaroos. Well, that's what we've got in the monastery. Out there, you've got dogs and cats and all that sort of stuff. So just that quality of mind that we generate by being a good person, a virtuous person. The meditation then builds on that. I don't think there's any sort of substitute for formal meditation in developing the mind towards the higher goal. And then there's the wisdom aspect as well, the insight into the nature of things. That's essentially the path to what we call nirvana. Nirvana's the Pali word, but you'd be familiar with the word nirvana, which is a Sanskrit word. And essentially, taken together, the virtue, the meditation, and the wisdom that culminates in the ultimate, which is, nirvana. It's kind of nice here, actually, because I go out and do a lot of teaching here and there. I teach at the Karnat prison. I teach at the Armadale Meditation Group. And generally, when you go out to these places, they instruct you to say, "Oh, don't talk about Buddhism, just talk about meditation, keep it... don't sully the waters with religion." So the point of the real point, the kind of thing that takes you out of way life and puts you in robes is really this pursuit of the complete liberation from suffering, from mental suffering, from physical suffering, from rebirth. That is very simply the ultimate goal of Buddhist meditation. That's not to say that you don't benefit from meditation, even if you're not a Buddhist and you don't really conceive of such stuff as rebirth and nirvana. That's fine. There's a lot of people out there that will teach you mindfulness-based stress reduction and meditation to make you a little bit more happier, a bit more comfortable in day-to-day life. The practice of mindfulness just as a kind of end in itself. For me personally, the reason I'm in robes, the reason I'm out here as a monk, it's a pursuit of that ultimate goal, however far off it might be. So, there you go. I think that's all the questions, and it's 9:15. We've done well. Yeah, so would anyone else like to ask any other questions? I've got a few minutes. Or you can just sit and have a very nice meditation this fine evening. Okay. All right. So, thank you for everyone who submitted a question. Hello. You just got your hands together. You look like you're asking something. That's right. Yeah, okay. Well, the night is still young, so you can sit, you can walk, or you can go to bed because you're tired. All are options. Okay, so thank you. Good night.